ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming. We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doog, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This story contains distressing content and includes some strong language. Listener discretion is advised.
By all accounts, Balmoral's op shop is a winner. It's lined with racks of coloured clothing, shelves of knickknacks, balls of wool, kids' games, crockery, books. It has it all. Even a tiny ceramic shoe collection. We're on a visit to Balmoral when we decide to drop in. Andy is rifling through this basket of minuscule shoes and getting acquainted with the volunteers behind the counter.
Oh, look, this one's a little salt and pepper shaker.
Yes. Oh, I reckon these ones came from Japan.
They
are gorgeous. Look at this.
I'm standing awkwardly beside Andy and the op shop ladies.
I kind of love the shoe collection. I sort of want it.
No, you don't.
With a large microphone branded with the ABC logo. And we tell the women behind the counter, Dot and Joy, what we're here making a podcast about. They dive right in.
Oh, that was awful.
Yeah. I mean, and we don't want, I appreciate that we've just sort of turned up here. So if you want, tell me if you want me to turn this off, but...
It's clear that Dot and Joy have canvassed this topic together before. And they launch straight back into how they feel about it all.
Just upset for all the families. Like, yeah. That's was what my thing was, and because knowing all the children involved.
Joy tells us it split the community.
Yeah. I mean, you'll get one side and you'll get the other. And they're just totally black and white.
Yeah, it is.
Even Dot and Joy are at odds with each other on this issue.
And if you've got family side of it, that will be one side.
The offender's family or the girl's family, yeah.
No, I agree with this. You don't?
No.
For Joy, the men were in the wrong.
Well, I see them as guilty perpetrators.
Dot's view is harder to pin down.
It did happen.
It happened.
Yes, it did happen.
Yeah. But, yeah, the alcohol involved.
Yeah, but that should be no excuse.
I don't know. They were.
And she said no.
Well, I just think it was, you know, that they were all very, very affected with alcohol. And I will have to say, the girl was no actual...
Dot doesn't finish her sentence before Joy cuts her off.
That's tough for you to say that too.
Well, it's not.
But what they had many sexual partners themselves, so why do you have to say that the girl's in the
Well, she's the one that, it blew up and, okay, yeah, I know, you'll shoot me down, but I'm just saying that, she was no innocent person, put it that way.
Andy asks the women about their thoughts on consent and the idea that no one ever really asks for sexual assault.
You know, that there's no kind of asking for it or being too slutty or flirty or... What do you reckon?
Well, that's probably where I fall down. Yeah, well...
What, the whole thing of that she's looking for it? Is that what you're saying?
Well, not looking for it, well, but yeah, I guess, suppose.
We asked the women if this town has learned from the case, but they seem confused by the question.
No, I wouldn't say that.
No. Why?
Well, I don't think so either. No, it was just a one-off thing, wasn't it? Like
just a one-off thing.
But what if it wasn't?
The way the town supported them and encouraged it and, like, kind of fostered and grew and bred this environment in their own community.
And what if this town still has questions to answer?
The town produced these boys and raised them. It's no wonder they are the way they are if the town is the way it is, if that makes sense.
I'm Charlotte King.
And I'm Andy Burns. And this is episode 6 of Hometown Boys. from Background Briefing. It's almost 10 years since the 21st birthday party when we visit Balmoral. This tiny town is still only home to around 280 people. And it's impossible not to be noticed.
Oh look, it's a Harrow Balmoral blue rose tree.
We drive past the property where police established a crime scene the morning after the party, over the road from the footy club.
That's the place. Pulling this way a bit so you can have a look. All right. So not a huge property, just a maybe an acre.
Yeah.
Scene of the crime, eh?
The same family who hosted the party still lives here.
Yeah, it was quite strange to drive past this sort of, you know, unassuming residential house, and we actually spot a caravan, you know, off to the side, rusting away in the paddock. And for a moment, I think we both went, is that the caravan?
That could have been it. It looked like a very crusty old caravan.
It turns out probably not. But it was just this kind of heart-in-the-mouth moment of going, oh, there's the place. This is the place.
I'll just do a Yui.
It's clear there's been so much hurt from all this, but there's never really been a reckoning in this town over what happened and why so many were, and still are, ready to rally behind the offenders. The place that sets this standard, the moral compass that guides the culture of Balmoral, that's the footy club. So that's where we need to go for answers.
It's a crisp day in July at the Balmoral Footy Oval. The day starts quite slow and it gathers pace as we build momentum towards the main event, which is the men's senior game. When it's time for the game, they come running out of the locker room like gladiators onto the field, and everyone's eyes are on this big group of burly men as they descend the stairs to the oval. They meet the opposing players head on with this real kind of brute force. And at half-time, they stand side by side in the huddle, just like the junior boys that we'd seen earlier in the day.
Really good response, okay, at half-time. Okay, we came out after quarter-time. We were a bit flat, okay, there's a couple of things that we weren't doing. We weren't hunting the footy, okay, we weren't putting our head over it.
The senior men go on to win their game, and this ritual of celebration happens again. For hours, we've been hanging around with the ABC microphone, just kind of trying to talk to club members. And then as the day comes to a close and the sun is setting, there's this fella that kind of sidles up to us on the boundary line. He's got this wry smile and he just sort of seems to be taking the measure of us. He pretty much stays on the boundary line all day and helps out with whatever they need. His name is Hamish. After everything started to quiet down, he gives us this cryptic invitation. He says that he and his wife were going to be having dinner at the Western Hotel in Balmoral a bit later, if we happen to be around.
Everyone else in town is still at the footy club. The pub is almost empty. Hamish and Felicity pull up out the front. They order a counter meal and we sit down at a table together. Hamish tucks into his palmer.
You've got to eat this before it gets cold.
You feel free to eat while we're chatting.
And Hamish's wife, Felicity, she kicks things off.
People that I work with were saying, oh, those poor blokes, you know, it's not a rape case, you know, it's just, you know, it's going to ruin those blokes' lives. And it was like, you know, they already made their mind up that they were innocent, you know, the towns of they were innocent, and she wasn't, sort of, didn't they? Well, I felt really sorry for her.
Hamish has lived in this town for 20 years. He's at the footy club every weekend. And he says when Luke came back from prison, it was backslapping all round.
You watch when he comes back, you'll get a hero's welcome. And you know what he fucking did. It was just incredible. You got this bloke who, well done, Luke, well done. Good on you for sticking up for our rights. It's fucking our daughters. You know?
They didn't say that.
No, I'm putting words in their mouth there. But just the handshakes in the back, it's good to see his back and all that sort of type attitude.
This meeting at the Western Hotel feels like an act of defiance for Hamish.
It's never been accepted that, hang on, the court has made their decision and it's not fair that we just keep living away as if it hasn't happened. The court, are not easily tricked. Well, these people are professionals. They're not fucking idiots. So it's maybe that's worth thinking about when you're walking around sprouting your opinion. You know, a very expensive lawyer was beaten by a 20-odd-year-old girl because she just had the truth on her side.
So we head off home from Balmoral to take stock of everything that we've learned while we've been here. A few months go by and we still haven't heard anything from the Harrow Balmoral Football Netball Club committee. I've been having numerous phone calls with their president, back and forth for a few months now, and she wants to talk about the positives at the club, but it appears that the committee block her at every turn. They have several meetings that I hear about to talk about the podcast and what they'll respond with. And still, we wait.
This is an opportunity, isn't it, for the club to engage with the ABC and say, look, yes, of course, this crime happened. We acknowledge that. We accept that. Lessons have been learnt. We respect women. We are against sexual violence 100%. And we want to make that clear. But there just seems to be this absolute unwillingness to even enter into the conversation.
I know they don't have a shiny PR team who's advising them what to do, but it feels a bit like they're kind of battening down the hatches and they're just thinking, we'll weather the storm. This will all blow over and we can just go back to the way things were. In the end, we get this one-line response from the club committee. It says, upon review, external advice and consideration, the committee respectfully declines to provide a response to this request. We sent dozens of questions, and that was it. We're not going to be deterred. You know, we're still hitting the phones, we're still trying to talk to people who are part of the club and having these background conversations with its members. And at some point, I called the treasurer. This guy's name is Simon Hodgson, but everybody calls him Twiggy. In terms of the hierarchy of the club, this guy is one of the ultimate insiders. He's on all the committees. He is super connected in the town. His family live on a road that's named after them. Like, it doesn't get any more local than that. He was at the home game the day that we were there, but he was quite prickly and he didn't seem like he was keen to chat. And then one day, you know, we just decide to ring him up and see how we go. And that's when I realised something had changed.
What's that?
So a couple of weeks after, we take the long drive back to Balmoral and we're heading down this winding dirt road.
743.
Google Maps does not work out here.
743. There was 399 back there. We're going the wrong way. We've
gone too far.
There were no other houses though.
It's pretty.
We get to his place and we walk inside.
Is the shoes off? No, you're right. No, they won't.
Oh, look at this beautiful view.
You guys like coffee or a tea?
He's a merino sheep farmer and the football club
it means the absolute world to him.
It's really, really important, and especially since, well, you know, church has gone by the wayside probably for a good for a good reason. So yeah, and so the new church is the, you know, is the Haribo Moral Football Club, really.
So of course I'm fascinated to know what's being said in these crisis meetings that the committee's having about the podcast. But he tells me, no, I'll be speaking as myself, as an individual, and not on behalf of the club. And without any prompting.
It just beggars belief how many people have, you know, taken the side of the rapists, really.
He gets straight to the point.
Luke and Sean completely fucked up and really, did something horrendous and atrocious. You know, leadership at the time must have thought that it was... worth trying to support them for their mental health while completely discounting, like, chucking a lease by the wayside sort of thing. You know, basically ostracised their whole family. And the footy club was a huge part of that as well.
And even though it's been 10 years, for Twiggy, it's still a live issue.
I'm totally torn about this whole thing. It's... because I'm still part of this club, and so many people that did support the rapists are still part of the club.
He feels like he has to push down his feelings about the case.
Yeah, I'll possibly lose a lot of friends over this, and it might be hard. It will be hard. We see Luke all the time. He's around all the time. You see people that are supporters of him all the time. You feel horrendous, you know, associating with these sorts of people, but it's sort of your friends, your community, it's your life. You can't just shut away.
At one point we asked Twiggy what he makes of Lisa Hutchins and her role in coming forward with a statement that triggered the retrial.
If it's the ones that I'm really worried about losing as friends, it's the Hutchins family, because they, you know, I'm really close to them and they mean a lot to me, so...
We don't realise just how close to the bone this is for him. And it quickly becomes clear that Twiggy's in an impossible situation here. He's doing the interview for Elise and her family. He's very fond of them. But he's also very close to the Hutchins family. They're some of his closest friends. And he starts to get emotional.
They're the ones I'm really close to, and they're the ones I'm like, how do they fucking support these... how do they fucking support them? I just don't get it. And they're the ones I'm really worried that they'll listen to this and think, you fucking idiot. Why are you saying what you're saying?
So as it stands for Twiggy, this whole saga sends a terrible message to anyone who might think about coming forward.
Yeah, imagine this sort of thing happens again. You would nearly think twice about reporting it if you know that that's how you're going to get treated. Yeah, I'd love to think we've changed, but God, I don't know if we have.
We asked Lisa Hutchins about the influence of her public support for Luke Merrifull. She replied that what she publicly supported was a fair trial and presentation of truth and fact, not individuals. I saw no sides, she said. There are no winners in this.
It's not the nicest of facilities.
Denny Slorak moved away from Balmoral years ago when she was a teenager. She now runs a community newspaper in Phillip Island, on the other side of Victoria. She's in her 40s and has a whole new life. But the town is seared in her memory.
It was very much, boys will be boys, they can do whatever they want, but girls are supposed to behave like this.
And nowhere was this more obvious than at the weekend home games.
If you were good on the team, you would be looked after because you were needed to be able to win so that this ritual of celebration could happen.
We're here meeting Denny because she has a story she wants to tell us. It's a childhood memory she hasn't been able to erase. One night, after a game, there's a dinner at the Memorial Hall.
Live band, and there'd be free cordial for the kids and things like that. And there were tables up the side and dancing in the middle.
Denny is 12 years old.
A lot of the younger football players in the seniors and reserves would congregate sort of between the door to the hall and the door to the toilets. And you had to really walk a gauntlet of men to get from the dance floor to go to the bathroom.
She's walking past this group of footballers on the way to the toilet.
I was just an average kid because my hair was everywhere and I didn't wear makeup. I wasn't there looking like I was older, inviting glances or anything. I would have been in jeans and a t-shirt.
And as she's walking past, she says one of the footballers reaches for her and she's grabbed by the hand.
And pushed up against a wall and he tried to kiss me.
Denny resists and turns her face away.
And when I said, get off me, no, he called me a frigid bitch, told me that no one would want me and I'd need to learn to do better or something along those lines.
She's shaken and she returns to the group of girls and their parents at her table and announces what's happened. But she's told,
you know, you're in a public place. What would have happened? So just, boys will be boys. Don't walk out there by yourself.
The lesson is clear.
It's not on the men to change. It's on the women to not invite it. You change your behaviour so that you don't get harassed and so that you don't get assaulted and you don't get groped.
Years have gone by since she was a 12-year-old netballer, frightened by a footballer in the dark. But for Denny, what happened to Elise is more of the same. The community made excuses for the men and blamed the woman. It tells Denny nothing's really changed in Balmoral.
Who knows how many other girls were in the exact same situation? I can't imagine that I would be the only girl that got in that close and that who was cornered that much, that didn't know how to say no, that didn't know how to push him away.
Elise had talked about red flags that she wished she'd paid more attention to, that in this town, the behaviour of the men was tolerated and even protected at the football club. Like that moment at the party with the footy player and the very drunk girl.
And one of the older footy boys sort of grabbed us and took us away. He's like, no, don't be around this. You're too young for this, but, you know, there's nothing unnatural going on here.
Yeah, and they bragged about her being a starfish, even though she was literally probably unconscious.
While investigating Elise's story, we start to hear about these other moments too. These murky incidents where the boundaries get blurred, all involving young men who played footy at the club at one time or another. There are several stories that we can't verify. We hit dead end after dead end because no one wants to talk. And then almost by accident, I end up on the phone with this woman we've never met. The woman on the other end of the line freezes and she goes silent. I'm expecting her to hang up. But instead, she quietly says that she put that memory in a box and that at the time, she was told she was asking for it. We thought that she might have been a girl from one of these stories we'd heard. Like the girl Elise and James saw in the dirt that night. She's not. It's another incident we haven't heard before. The woman agrees to meet us in a Melbourne suburb.
It actually sent a shiver down my spine because after we called her the other day and spoke to her, I sent her a message saying, you know, I know that was a lot and I hope you're okay and you've got someone nearby. And she sent back a message and said, I told my mum for the first time ever today about what happened to me.
We meet in a high street cafe, busy with a lunch crowd. The tables outside are full of people chatting. A woman is sitting alone at a table on the end, quietly nursing her cappuccino. She's in her 30s and she's got these big, searching eyes. We'll call this woman Laura, but that's not her real name. She's shaking too much to sip her coffee, but she holds it together. She won't be interviewed. She's too terrified of speaking publicly. But in this cafe, she tells us her story. We leave pretty floored, and we don't know if we'll hear from her again. But finally, after months of back and forth, she decides she wants to speak.
Yes, mic here. Testing, testing. I can see me.
Testing. Am I going? Am I working?
Yeah. We've changed her voice to protect her identity.
I was branded very early as that kind of girl, or she's a slut type of thing. And you can't move out of that. So, like, once it was decided that I was that kind of person, I was never able to date or, I guess it was just expected that that's what I would be, and I was nothing.
She shares graphic details that we're unable to repeat because we've given assurances not to identify her. And it means that we can't investigate her allegation as we normally would. If we start asking around about this incident, people will know who she is. But we want to hear her perspective.
I look back and I think, you know, at those early football parties where I did start drinking really early to get over my social anxiety, you know, you wanted to be cool and you wanted people to talk to you, which in a small community, you want a friend, you know, you want at least a friend.
She tells us that she was blamed for the incident and called a slut. That she was abandoned by her friends. That she was told it was her fault. It was years before the 21st birthday where Elise was raped and involved a completely different football player from the club. That night, Laura was blacked out and only remembers fragments of what happened. She was at a football function, and a player from the team at the time had sex with her in front of a lot of people. She says she was too drunk to consent and was left with injuries afterwards. Laura left Balmoral after high school, but still has ties in the community, and she's watched the culture around the senior men's football team for years.
It's sort of what people want for you to grow up and marry a good farmer who can play football. And if you ever bring a boyfriend home, you know, from out of town, the first question isn't, you know, how'd you meet or what is it? It's, can he play football and will he come and play for us?
She paints a picture of a town that treats A-grade footballers like gods and where boundaries are blurred around consent.
I guess if it's not a hard no, it's not a no in sort of in their eyes. Like if it's not, you're not explicitly saying no, whether you're pissed or whatever doesn't really seem to matter. Like if you, I think probably if you're able to walk off with them, that's all the consent they need.
And she backs up what Elise and James say about murky incidents they witnessed in the town.
I think there were a lot of incidents like that with sort of people my age, or it was just kind of expected you'd get pissed and sort of be, the boys would be expected that they could go and have sex with someone. And it's good on you, mate, you know, you've got another one or whatever it is. But as a girl, you know, if you had sex once when you're 15, that's it, you're branded, that's you done. You're sort of unmarriable, yeah.
And Laura says that's what happened to her after the night she says she was sexually assaulted.
Especially after that, that was just take what you want type of situation. I was ashamed that
people had watched or seen it happen, and that was my fault, and I was such a slut for letting that happen. Like, it was pretty painful. And it just really made me question, maybe it was my fault. Maybe I shouldn't have got so pissed.
Watching Elise go up against the club from afar confirmed her decision to keep quiet all these years.
Imagine what they would do to me. It would just be, you're making it up, you're remembering it wrong, you're just, you know, trying to make things hard for this family, and it's social suicide, basically.
But hearing Elise's story gave her something else too.
I probably would have gone through my whole life not trusting myself. I would have continued thinking it was me. It was just this overwhelming, oh my God, it wasn't okay. Just this validation, and I was right this whole time. It wasn't my fault.
It's almost spring when I get down to Elise's parents' farm. They've been here close to 5 years now, and it's home.
Howdy puppies, here they are.
Elise is here for a visit, just in time to welcome a huge and very cute litter of puppies. After she introduces the dogs, she shows me this little lamb and calf that are orphans she's been looking after.
And these are my pets, pet lamb and pet calf. We have Naz and Marshall.
The pet lamb and calf are named after St Kilda football players.
I'm mad Saints supporter, and I'm very excited that Naz has $2 million signed on.
Elise is actually wearing a Saints beanie as we chat.
I'm like, yup, this is the year. This is the year, guys. But we're coming up. I have faith. I don't know when it'll happen, but it's exciting. We're playing some really good footy, so I'm really into it.
Elise and Bevan show me the old wool shed where the sheep are shorn.
Draft all the lambs off into those two big pens. Then we mark them, and then the ewes run down, then we drench the ewes, and then they run back out together, yeah. See how it sort of works.
Being inside this wool shed is like stepping back 100 years. It smells of lanolin and has wooden catching pens and a tally board. The shed's empty, but it's got the ghosts of shearers from the decades past. They're images of strength and determination. Brute force. Strong, tough men. It makes me think of that moment in the Western Hotel when Luke's dad, Peter Merrifield, told Bevan's son, James, to be a man and shake his hand. Bevan, he's had to push a lot of that down. He spent years holding back his anger about what happened to his daughter. And now it's turned into a deep, bruising sadness that's mixed in with a whole heap of pride for Elise.
Stuck to her guns. Yeah, it'd be a tough thing to do. Yeah, especially when you've been through it all. No, very proud of her. Yeah. I just hope it helps a lot of other women.
A heavy rain starts to fall on the woolshed roof. I want to know what Bevan thinks of that idea, of what it means to be a man.
Yeah, but, well, being a man's not that. Being a man's looking after your family, isn't it?
Elise has been quietly listening to her dad from the other couch. She comes over and hugs him tightly.
I love you, Dad.
Oh, well. Yeah, so that's what a man is, Ollie.
The rain stops and we head back outside. Elise wants to show me her camper van. In a few days, she's off on a road trip to South Australia with her beloved dogs.
This is my van. So it's in the process of being done up very slowly because things are expensive, but we have a dual battery, we have a fridge, we have a bed. I have a little like gas stove, I have a table. I'm hoping to do lots of big trips in here, especially like I want to do across.
It brings her a kind of freedom she doesn't feel like she has in her day-to-day life.
I guess I just like feeling like I can do things without people asking me if I'm okay or if I'll manage or what's going to happen if something happens. Just driving in my van with my dogs, especially when I'm in country, like, you know, regional places, it just feels like, yep, this is who I am. I'm at home. I'm in my place. Love this.
She's starting to feel for the first time in years like she can separate herself from everything that happened that night in the caravan.
It's really nice. I haven't felt like this in a long, long time. Like, long, long time. So, like, it's, you know, it's okay. It's like I have difficulties, obviously, but, you know, everyone does with different things. You just kind of figure it out.
I ask Elise if she has a message for her hometown.
Gosh, what would I say? I think my message would be just think about your actions in those moments. Think about those moments where you had a choice to stand up and say something and how things could have been different if people did stand up and say something. It would have made a huge difference for me and for my family if people, after the fact, you know, cared.
If you've experienced sexual assault and you need support, you can call Full Stop Australia on 1800 385 578. That's 1800 385 578. This series is a collaboration between the ABC's Regional Investigations Team and Background Briefing. Background Briefing's sound producers are Lila Schunner and Ingrid Wagner. Sound engineering by Simon Branthwaite. Music composition by Emrys Cronin and Joshua Curtis. Fact-checking by Justine Landis-Hanley. Our rollout producer is Ben Sveen. The supervising producer is Max Chalmers. And the executive producer is Fanu Falali. I'm Charlotte King.
And I'm Andy Burns. To hear more episodes, search for the Background Briefing podcast on ABC Listen. Thanks for listening.